So generosity is it's characteristic of Buddhism. It's characteristic of Buddhists in a way. It's one of the qualities that immediately come to mind, immediately associated with Buddhism. I think maybe the image of the monk with his arms ball has been a symbol of generosity, the generosity of the Buddhist disciples down the ages. And it's probably interesting in that respect to note that the monks don't ask for anything. They don't ask. They remain silent. So they don't request alms. And however, in the West, in the Sri Ratna Buddhist community, and I think in probably all of the Western Buddhist communities, we do ask. We fundraise. We ask for donations and so on. That's the norm. Partly because we don't have a tradition of alms and so on, of monks standing silently with their bowl. But really, Buddhist generosity shouldn't really be in response to a request. It should ideally be something that's ongoing all the time, regardless of whether you're asked or not. Just a simple and continuous application of our ethical principles. So a flow of time, energy, money, whatever, in the direction of your heartfelt values. Yeah? So giving is one of the key practices for any Buddhist, and one of the delights, you could say, of the spiritual community. I don't think I have enough time this evening to go into why, you know, like the fundamental question, well, why be generous? What's the point of it? I don't really have time to go into that, but I'll say that basically it comes from the Buddhist idea that we are all interdependent and interconnected, and that basically it's in our own and everybody else's interests that we are generous, that we're open-hearted and open-handed. Behind that teaching, there's other teachings which I don't have time to go into tonight, about the nature of self and so on. So all of us, I would imagine, give. And probably we do give continuously in one way or another. There's a very broad spectrum, I think, of generosity. I suppose the spectrum runs from zero generosity to a completely spontaneous generosity with probably no distinguishable end point. You could say there's probably no limit to generosity, no limit to that quality. There is, of course, a limit to our ability to be generous. The fact that there's no limit to generosity doesn't mean there isn't a limit to our ability to be generous. Most of us have limits. Most of us have probably encountered those limits from time to time. But the challenge for most of us is how to be a little bit more generous, how to step a little bit outside of our comfort zone when it comes to generosity. So there's this broad spectrum of generosity. I was going to give you a couple of examples of the different ends of that spectrum, from pretty much zero generosity to a completely spontaneous, uninhibited generosity. And the first one that came to mind is not a real person, but the character of Mr. Scrooge from The Christmas Carol by Charles Dickens. I suppose he's the archetypal miser, is Mr. Scrooge. He's the fundraiser's nightmare. I was thinking of Gina when I was writing this earlier, because Gina goes around knocking on people's doors and fundraising for Karuna, the charity that does good work in India. And this little passage I'm going to read from Christmas Carol is... basically, there are a couple of fundraisers who come to Mr. Scrooge on Christmas Eve looking for money. a couple of men. It says, they were portly gentlemen, pleasant to behold, and now they stood with their hats off in Scrooge's office. They had books and papers in their hands and bowed to him. Scrooge and Marley's, I believe, said one of the gentlemen, referring to his list. Have I the pleasure of addressing Mr. Scrooge or Mr. Marley? Mr. Marley has been dead these 7 years, Scrooge replied. He died 7 years ago, this very night. We have no doubt his liberality is well represented by his surviving partner, said a gentleman, presenting his credentials. It certainly was, for they had been two kindred spirits. At the ominous word liberality, Scrooge frowned and shook his head and handed the credentials back. At this festive season of the year, Mr. Scrooge, said a gentleman, taking up a pen, it is more than usually desirable that we should make some slight provision for the poor and destitute, who suffer greatly at the present time. Many thousands are in want of common necessaries. Hundreds of thousands are in want of common comforts, sir. Are there no prisons? Asked Scrooge. Plenty of prisons, said the gentleman, laying down the pen again. And the union workhouses, demanded Scrooge, are they still in operation? They are still, returned the gentleman. I wish I could say they were not. The treadmill and the poor law are in full vigour then, said Scrooge. Both are very busy, sir. Oh, I was afraid from what you said at first that something had occurred to stop them in their useful course, said Scrooge. I'm very glad to hear it. Under the impression that they scarcely furnish Christian cheer of mind or body to the multitude, returned the gentleman, a few of us are endeavouring to raise a fund to buy the poor some meat and drink and means of warmth. We choose this time because it is a time of all others when want is keenly felt and abundance rejoices. What shall I put you down for? Nothing, replied Scrooge. You wish to be anonymous. I wish to be left alone, said Scrooge. Since you ask me what I wish, gentlemen, that is my answer. I don't make merry myself at Christmas, and I can't afford to make idle people merry. I help to support the establishments I have mentioned. They cost enough. It goes on like that. So Mr. Scrooge can stand for the lowest end of the spectrum as a world of generosity. Mr. Scrooge is, as I said, a fundraiser's nightmare. He's fictional, of course, but I think probably with fictional characters, the reason why they work is because there's some resonance with something in actual people, and possibly even some resonance with something in us. Yeah. So although we're not Scrooge, there's something in us that can relate to him. Then there's the other end of the spectrum, and I've got a couple of examples just to cheer you up as well after Mr. Scrooge. So this is a story told by Sangharakshita about a Tibetan Lama that he visited. He says, a friend of mine who was a lay Nyingmapa Buddhist took me into Benares to see a Tibetan Lama, not an incarnate Lama, an ordinary monk, who was living there to learn Sanskrit. His name was Tenzin Gyaltso. He was over 70. The Dalai Lama had wanted him to start teaching, but he had refused. He told the Dalai Lama that he was far too busy learning. He hadn't finished his studies. So he settled in Benares to study Sanskrit. We found him at a place almost like a typical Hindu ashram. He had a little room at the top, but it was quite bare. He was sitting on the floor with a tin trunk in front of him, which served as his desk and table, with just a little text on it, which he was studying. He was very pleased to see me, and we talked for about an hour. As we rose to depart, he said, I really must give you something. He looked around the room, but there was absolutely nothing. I could see he was almost desperate. He had nothing but his mala, his beads. So he broke his mala and gave me one bead. Please take this. I must have said many millions of mantras on it. It's all I have to give you. So I think that's a very strong example of generosity. Someone who's impelled to generosity. It's just their whole nature, as it were. The other example is quite a different one, not a Buddhist. The great American poet, Walt Whitman. Walt Whitman was a very large-hearted, compassionate character. And his activities during the Civil War in America in the 19th century were, I think, so bodhisattva-like. I've always been really moved reading about Walt Whitman during the Civil War. So one of his biographers writes, from December 1862 until well after the war was over, he personally visited tens of thousands of hurt, lonely, and scared young men in the hospitals in and around Washington, bringing them the ineffable but not inconsiderable gift of his magnetic, consoling presence. In the process, he lost forever his own good health, beginning a long decline that would leave him increasingly enfeebled for the rest of his life. To his credit, he never regretted his wartime service or what it had cost him personally. I only gave myself, he told a friend. I got the boys. And more to the point, they got him. Whitman entered the rank, fever-ridden hospitals in the nation's capital like a literal breath of fresh air, bringing with him a knapsack full of humble but much appreciated gifts. Fruit, candy, clothing, tobacco, books, magazines, pencils, and paper. His long white beard, wine-coloured suit, and bulging bag of presents gave him a decided resemblance to Santa Claus. And the wounded soldiers, many of them still in their teens, called after him plaintively at the end of each visit, Walt, Walt, come again. And it goes on to say that he did. He kept going back and back of that. And another little bit I just picked off the internet. It says, Whitman provided an invaluable service to thousands of wounded and sick soldiers merely by being their friend. He would bring small gifts, sit by their beds and listen to them speak of their homes, their hopes and their fears. He would also write letters for those who were unable to do so, lend a gentle hand to hold, and even provide that last tender moment of human contact that so many of the dying needed. And not mentioned in that those quotes I've mentioned, he also wrote letters to the parents after these young boys, really, after they died. He often wrote long, beautiful letters to their parents, just talking about their last few weeks or whatever. So he really worked incredibly generously and hard during that period. And it wasn't part of his duties or anything. He just did it really out of compassion. So in Buddhism, of course, we have this ideal of the bodhisattva. The bodhisattva is the one who seeks to gain enlightenment or awakening for the sake of self and others. And that's been the goal of Buddhism right from the beginning. The bodhisattva is sometimes associated with later Buddhism, but actually it's been the goal of Buddhism right from the beginning. I've read this quote before, but I'll read it again. It's from the Pali Canon. The Buddha is speaking. It's in this kind of convoluted way that the Pali Canon is written, but he says, of two people who practice the Dharma in line with the Dharma, having a sense of the Dharma, having a sense of meaning, one who practices for both his own benefit and that of others, and one who practices for his own benefit, but not that of others. The one who practices for his own benefit, but not that of others, is to be criticized for that reason. The one who practices for both his own benefit and that of others is for that reason to be praised. So those are the two ends of the spectrum, from zero generosity up to the generosity of the Bodhisattva, the Walt Whitman's, that Tibetan Lama. So it's all the way from Mr. Scrooge to awakening. There's that kind of spectrum. We could call it the Scrooge Bodhisattva spectrum. Anyway, I imagine most of us are quite a long way from the Scrooge end of the spectrum. And I think that's really important to acknowledge. It's really important to acknowledge that we're not, as it were, at zero or whatever. When it comes to any spiritual practice, or actually when it comes to any undertaking at all, really, it's good to acknowledge and appreciate what we already have in place. It may not seem much, but we have a lot in place. So we're not starting from zero. We're building on a foundation of existing qualities, existing activities, existing aspirations. We're building on that foundation. And that applies to our generosity as well. We already have generosity. We already have generous hearts. So our task is not to become generous, but simply to practice generosity more and more. Working, as it were, with our own limitations, working with whatever we individually need to work with in order to be a little bit more generous. So practicing generosity involves letting go of various attachments as well, and generating a sense of abundance in our lives. And I was thinking of one way we could think about this is just thinking in terms of what gets in the way of being generous. What gets in the way of being generous? What steps could we take to overcome our resistances, our hindrances to being generous? And I was thinking that we're probably all, if we've been meditating for a while and learned about meditation, we're probably all familiar with the hindrances to meditation, the five. But if we're not familiar with them as a Buddhist list, we're probably familiar at least with some of them in our actual experience. Yeah. So the list of hindrances to meditation are restlessness and anxiety, first of all. Secondly, sense desire or craving. Thirdly, doubt and indecision. Fourthly, sloth and torpor, so kind of sleepiness. And fifthly, ill will. So those are the kind of hindrances that we encounter in meditation. Some of us will encounter maybe sleepiness, and others might encounter restlessness. So it's not, obviously, we tend not to encounter the whole spectrum, and certainly not in every meditation. We might over a lifetime of meditating. So I was thinking that we could think of those hindrances to meditation not just as hindrances to meditation, but as states of consciousness or states of mind that are obstacles to all spiritual practice, as it were, including being obstacles to that spontaneous, uninhibited flow of generosity, open-handed generosity. So that first hindrance, restlessness and anxiety, so that's a kind of state of mind that's worried about security and is in constant need of stimulation. Constant need of stimulation and pleasure just to keep worry at bay. I must say, this is the hindrance that I myself have been most familiar with in my life, particularly restlessness. When I first started meditating, I was so restless that I couldn't sit for 10 minutes even. I just could not do it. So I was just too much energy. Yeah, that was a long time ago. So life is uncertain, isn't it? Life is uncertain, and it really can't be controlled. But we desperately want to control it. We want to control life and we want to create certainty. I mean, you could say that probably most of our self-inflicted suffering comes from trying to control life, trying to control our world, as it were. And restlessness is characterized by energy. It's characterized by, you know, as I said, wanting stimulation, wanting pleasure, or whatever. But it's characterized by energy. And energy is actually quite a good thing. It's as a word, a positive counterpart of restlessness is what we call virya, energy in pursuit of the good. So restlessness leads to lots of distraction. Yeah? But the energy of restlessness can be channeled. And if you're very restless, what your task is to try and use the energy in some kind of positive way. So you have to channel it. You have to use it. You have to do things. So it means giving energy to the things you believe in, to the values you hold dear. So in a sense, that means generosity. If you suffer from distraction and restlessness, the antidote to it is just to give your energy to the things that you really value. That's what I did, I must say, myself. I just threw myself into things and gave my energy to them. And that at least meant that the energy was getting used positively. And anxiety, Subhuti talks about this in Mind in Harmony as a troubled mind. Anxiety is a troubled mind. So in a way, the positive side of anxiety would be something like remorse, if you'd done something wrong, feeling remorse. The negative side of it, of course, is that it's just anxiety without any positive sort of reason or outcome. But it can be, as it were, transformed into recognizing the consequences of our actions. And to do that, to transform restlessness and anxiety into something more positive, one of the things we need to do is to cultivate a sense of abundance in our lives. Cultivate a sense of delight in the beauty around us. We could just try to take the time or reorientate our minds or whatever to remind ourselves of the things we have enjoyed during the day, for instance, to remind ourselves of what's beautiful in our surroundings. So often we walk through life, we cycle through life in Cambridge, we race through life, and we see nothing. We don't notice nothing. So, and there's just so much that's rich. In a way, it's a practice of mindfulness. It's a practice of awareness, isn't it? Just to notice what's actually there. And that noticing, that enjoyment of what's actually there, it takes up the energy and the anxiety. It actually starts to expand our consciousness. So it can be very little things, so just the flowers in the park, or meeting a friend, or the laughter of children, or something. Just noticing and being aware and enjoying the things that are around us. I was just enjoying seeing bees the other day, bees taking the pollen from the flowers. So the more we remind ourselves of what's enjoyable, what's beautiful in our lives, the more we'll notice and appreciate beauty and pleasure everywhere. So it's like a cumulative thing. You start to notice and experience beauty and so on, and then it grows and it grows. And when that grows, what's happening is our consciousness, our mind, is changing. We're modifying ourselves. We're becoming more expansive. We start to have a more expansive state of consciousness. And that more expansive state of consciousness quite naturally expresses itself in generosity. The second hindrance, the hindrance of sense desire or craving, You could say that's all about wanting to possess or hold on to objects or people that we think will bring us happiness, or maybe not even bring us happiness, but to bolster or shore up our sense of self, our sense of identity, our sense of who we are. So that's a state of mind that's very focused on our own satisfaction, and basically it's an attempt to avoid suffering. And probably all of these kind of more negative states of mind are an attempt to avoid suffering, but the problem with them is that they're an attempt to avoid suffering that doesn't work. Yeah. It's not that there's something wrong with trying to avoid suffering, but you want a strategy that works rather than one that doesn't work. So when we're craving an object or a person, when we're intensely focused on that, what we tend to do is we tend to focus intently on the positive aspects and completely ignore the negative aspects. So some of you might have experienced this. Maybe you fell in love one time, and so that person you fell in love with was completely wonderful, completely positive. They had all these positive qualities. You probably bored your friends to death with how wonderful they were. Yeah? And of course, as time goes by, you realize that, well, yes, they are wonderful, but they're not completely wonderful. Yeah? Perhaps they've got a few faults. Yeah? And the same kind of thing can apply to anything. We get a craving for a new iPhone or a new computer or a car or I don't know, whatever it is, some item of clothing or something like that. And it's like it's completely positive. It's going to bring us some kind of happiness, pleasure, whatever, fulfillment. But then we get it and that wears off. Maybe quite quickly, maybe it takes a while, but it wears off. So you could say in this way we're always setting ourselves up for disappointment. And this probably applies to most of us, but particularly if it's a very strong tendency, we need to start to reflect on, well, what's really in our best interests? Mm-hmm. What really makes us happy? What really works, as it were? Even what do we really desire? What do we really want? What are we projecting onto those things and people that we want to possess or cling on to? So it could be that doing something like the metta bhavana or cultivating friendships and so on could alleviate some of the more extreme forms of craving. Or engaging with the natural world, or engaging with the arts. Those things that kind of enrich us. What you might call higher sources of pleasure. They have the effect of calming the mind. Yeah? Leading us to a sense of contentment. Contentment is the opposite of craving. Contentment is a very positive state of mind. A very positive state of mind that's easily satisfied, prefers simplicity, and not overly attached to things or people. When I say attached, I mean attached in that kind of possessive way. I don't mean being cold or cool or something like that. So when we're contented, it's very easy to be generous. It's very easy to be concerned with the welfare of others. We might have experienced this if we've been on retreat. You might have experienced how satisfying and how pleasurable it is to be contented. Even sometimes just after a meditation, if you've had a particularly good meditation, you feel this kind of contentment for immediately afterwards, and how pleasurable and satisfying that is. Mm. And again, being contented feels joyful. It feels expansive again, and therefore generous. The third hindrance to meditation is doubt and indecision. And of course, it's probably quite easy to see how doubt and indecision can get in the way of being generous. If we're really very prone to doubt and indecision, we might always have second thoughts. We might have second thoughts about whether to give, And I'm not talking necessarily about giving money. It could be giving time, it could be giving energy, it could be giving anything. We might have second thoughts about whether to give or about how much to give or whether what we're giving to is really worthwhile or whether our giving will make any difference. There's all these questions that can come in. And all of that can put us into a state of indecision, which might never be resolved. Yeah? Some of those questions you might never be able to answer them. Yeah? So second thoughts are often less generous thoughts. Yeah? They're often self-protective thoughts. These second thoughts then can gradually turn off the tap of generous impulses until that flow becomes a trickle, and then the trickle becomes nothing. Yeah, like Mr. Scrooge. So we need to be clear about our values, what we value most in life, and try to just allow our generosity to flow as it were after our values. And if we're really indecisive, we might just need to act impulsively from time to time. Just do it. Yeah, don't allow the second thoughts to get in the way. Act on impulse. Yeah, that's probably not a traditional Buddhist teaching, but I'm telling you, act on impulse if you're indecisive about being generous. Of course, generosity is also can also be a training. In the precepts are known as training precepts. So the precepts assume you're not generous. They assume you're not completely ethical. They're training us to be more ethical, to be more kind and generous and so on. And the way we train ourselves is by practicing something. You train yourself to do it by practicing it. So generosity is also a training. We can practice generosity just in the same way we practice meditation. It can be something we do every day. And it's something that we do every day which has the effect of changing our mental states, gradually modifying our habitual personality. That's what meditation does. Generosity can do the same thing. In fact, it could be argued that generosity is a more important practice than meditation, because meditation can very easily become a self-centered activity. And I must say, I have seen that happen. It can become a self-centered activity. It can become an ego-making activity. Yeah? Whereas generosity is always moving beyond self and has the potential to lead to ever greater self-transcendence, which is what Buddhism is all about. Yeah? So the fourth hindrance to meditation is often referred to as sloth and torpor. We could talk about it as maybe sleepiness or something like that. It's maybe not so straightforward. As a hindrance to meditation, it's probably not as straightforward as that phrase might suggest, but for the purposes of this talk, I'm going to take it to mean a dull, passive, forgetful, unaware state of mind. And in relation to generosity, that would mean something like not noticing what's needed or forgetting immediately. So it's not so much about not being generous, it's about not even noticing that generosity might apply, mm-hmm. as it were. Yeah, you see what I mean. Mm-hmm. So we might have good intention, or a step on from that is where we might have good intentions but not follow through. We might have good intentions for, you know, briefly, and then we don't follow through, which I think is, again, something that anyone who's ever done any fundraising has experienced, that people can make pledges but not follow through. And of course, the antidote to that kind of thing is mindfulness and promptitude. When we're meditating, one of the things that meditation teachers will suggest, if you're experiencing this kind of sleepiness or dullness, they'll suggest that you open your eyes, because having your eyes closed tends towards sleepiness. So they suggest that you open your eyes. So we could think of this as a metaphor too. We could think of opening our eyes to what's going on around us and to the reality and the needs of other people. So in terms of practicing generosity, we need to open our eyes to other people, to the circumstances around us, what's needed. Of course, all of these hindrances overlap. They're all, it's like with most of these lists that you get in Buddhism, they seem to be talking about something quite distinct, but actually they tend to overlap because states of mind are not so boundaried as that. Therefore, when we're talking about these hindrances and resistances, often there'll be quite a mixture in them. Just as our minds are quite a mixture, our minds are often quite a mess, aren't they? They're not so clear as all that. And similarly, the ways forward will often be the same thing. So that kind of mindfulness, awareness, promptitude, generating a sense of abundance, and all of these things will be how to counteract most of the hindrances. Then the last hindrance is ill will. And I was thinking in relation to generosity, this is very much the realm of Mr. Scrooge. This is what you could call a curmudgeonly attitude. Yeah. Mr. Scrooge is probably literature's prime example of this miserly attitude. In some ways, this is like the behaviour of a small child who doesn't want to share his or her toys. Yeah, it's mine. Why should I? An adult might add something like, "I've worked for it. Mm-hmm. I need it." Yeah, whatever. And often at the bottom of this kind of ill will or miserliness is some fear or insecurity. Yeah. So it's a kind of psychological issue. Of course, if it's really strong, it's probably something that needs therapeutic help. Although, interestingly enough, Mr. Scrooge is cured by a more spiritual vision, basically. Mr. Scrooge has, you could say, he has a vision of the consequences of his actions. That's what happens. He's shown in a series of dreams, he's shown that if he carries on how he's carrying on, that it will bring great suffering on himself. So Mr. Scrooge is cured by this spiritual process of realizing something about the consequences of his actions. And in the Pali Canon, it's often mentioned in relation to generosity or acts of generosity, that we should try to be aware of the consequences of generous actions. We should need to be aware that actually they have positive consequences. So that's, you know, that it's basically saying, be aware that generous actions have positive consequences, and that reinforces your impulse to be generous, yeah? So yes, it's helpful to reflect on the positive consequences as well as the limiting or whatever the consequences of not being generous. So it's our state of mind, basically, is what I'm saying, that holds us back from being generous. Often, it's not lack of time or lack of energy or lack of money. It's more likely to be something like a poverty mentality. Yeah. Now, not to say that some people may be ill or have less energy, or some people may be relatively poor and so on. But for most of us, and I'm not just talking about people in this room, I'm talking about those who are listening to this recording as well, and those who don't hear. Most of us are relatively healthy and relatively well off even, and we can afford to give time and energy and money to something, hopefully to that which we most value. So at the beginning, I mentioned the Scrooge Bodhisattva spectrum. And of course, I just want to say that this is not very fair to Mr. Scrooge. Yeah. It's not very... Because in the end, he becomes a very generous character. Yeah. He's remembered for being a miser, but actually in the end, he becomes a very generous character. I guess the message there is that Mr. Scrooge, bad as he was, wanting people to go to prison rather than get a warm Christmas dinner or whatever, Mr. Scrooge was capable of change. And if Mr. Scrooge was capable of change, then we are capable of change, yeah? Mr. Scrooge could change because, miserly as he was, the seeds of generosity were nevertheless in his heart. And of course, we can change and we can grow because the seeds of generosity have already sprouted in our lives. They're already sprouted in our hearts. So we only need to nurture those seeds. And in time, there will be a flowering of that awakening heart, as it were. And when that happens, when it happens to a large degree, we will forget all about being generous, because generosity will be as natural to us as breathing. The last line of A Christmas Carol by Charles Dickens says of Scrooge, it says, his own heart laughed, and that was quite enough for him. So may all our hearts learn to laugh and give of their abundance. Okay, so that's the talk. Thank you.